Hey there, it's Stephanie here. This episode comes with a content warning. This is simply to empower you, the audience, with the knowledge you need to make healthy decisions about how and if you should consume this podcast content. We talk about mental illness, suicide, and depression. There are also mentions of medication, alcohol, and marijuana use in this episode, all of which I know can be distressing. A list of resources are available in the podcast description, where I have tried to list as many hotlines, info pages, and supports I could find. Please take care of yourself, and if you need to, don't be afraid to reach out and ask for help.
I'm so glad you're here.
Hello, and welcome to Town Rituals Red Tent Gathering. Today, we're talking about mental health and mental illness. According to Public Health Canada, mental health is the state of your psychological and emotional well-being. It is a necessary resource for living a healthy life and a main factor in overall health. It does not mean the same thing as mental illness. However, poor mental health can lead to mental and physical illness. To become aware of one's mental health, I suspect many of us need to take a trip down that bumpy, windy, fast-paced, tubular slide towards mental illness and destabilization. In my early 20s, I woke up one day to a startling truth. I was slowly spiraling down towards a place of no return. I needed to make different life choices. I was teetering on addiction. I enjoyed a party lifestyle that was not necessarily reserved to weekends. I experienced few consequences. I was gainfully employed, my career moving ahead. I had a wonderful apartment in the core and a fantastic group of friends. My bills and debts mostly paid. What was there to lose? Measuring consequences was really hard. It was a dream that pushed me to my truth. I still remember looking down into a spinning tornado, objects and moments from life caught within, a swirling mass of moments surrounded by misery. If I continued towards it, I was going to be sucked right into the storm's core and I would drown. So I started with therapy, where I was told there was nothing they could or would do for me until I had a stretch of sobriety. After a lot of tears and searching for support, I was admitted to a 12-week outpatient program at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, or CAMH, located in Toronto, Canada. There, I joined others in group therapy. And from that, I realigned with my life goals and purpose, moving forward with new intentions and focus. A decade later, I found myself in the deep well of postpartum depression. I was suffering before I even left the hospital. I continued to exist in this state for a long time, and I at times thought these experiences and wild emotions were normal. I told myself I'd had a baby and this was the cost. I also wanted to give my body time to adjust, to breastfeed, to recover from the birth, and to balance out before I put myself on medication. I also needed support to deal with the traumatic birth and the grief from a personal loss that occurred a few months later. I was told by a doctor, again, that there was nothing that they would or could do for me if I was not willing to take medication. I was discharged as their patient and left to continue putting myself on wait lists, banging on doors, being rejected over and over again, despite the very real need. I eventually found the support I needed. I also eventually put myself on medication once I had developed a series of tools for my mental health toolbox. My experience showed me that accessing resources was a constant chore of banging on doors, waiting, wait list after wait list, until not a door opened, but eventually a window. I had to pull myself up into the place I needed to be. There was no walking in with ease. The system was then and is now impenetrable, even when you know how to get there. There are very few paths to recovering from mental illness that are not fraught with obstacles. The constant need to fight and advocate for yourself while existing and participating in society is exhausting when you've already run dry. Good mental health, once we know what that is a lifelong endeavor. So when the system you've turned to for help tunes you out and turns you away, where do you go? How do you step into a place of good mental health? Joining me today are Anthea, Mary, and Celeste, who is becoming quite the regular guest. I am so glad you're here. So I've been slightly open about my own struggles with mental illness, and I'm curious, kind of those of you joining, if you have any questions for me, or if you have something you'd like to share around your own experiences and your ongoing efforts to maintain good mental health. So Celeste, I thought I might have you start us off today.
Yeah, there was one word that you said that stuck with me, is how exhausted you are when you're dealing with all of this, and still you have to find your own way out, still you have to advocate for yourself. And I think the exhaustion is just, that deserves a capital E. Yeah. I'll be very transparent. I'm a bit nervous tonight. It's a topic that's very near to my heart and very central to my life. Bit emotional. It's the first day of my period. You know, everything's just coming together today. But you know, this is a safe space, so I'm glad to share all of this with you. So my journey with mental illness actually starts with my own mother. She had a burnout when I was 10, which it was seen as a burnout, but it degenerated into, she was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, and completely ended her career. She was never able to work again. That said, I was sheltered from a lot of the darker aspects of her illness, and I have a lot of admiration for my mother, because she really did the work, and she did what she needed to do. And she was never medicated. She went through the system. She was hospitalized, found a psychiatrist, tried meds, but she had so many reactions to the medications that she couldn't tolerate any of them. And then I think eventually they did found one medication that she could tolerate, but she's described it. She's like, well, I mean, it basically, like, she said it. Sorry, I'm struggling a bit, ladies.
It's okay. Take your time.
Yeah. But yeah, she said, it's like, well, what's the point of me taking this medication? It just eradicates all my emotions. So yeah, I don't feel sad, but it's because I don't feel a damn thing. Like, it's like not being human anymore. So she dealt with her illness naturally through and through. Now she's considered a light case according to psychiatry. But I think light case deserves a bit of respect, because, I mean, she lost her career. She was never able to work again. She was officially recognized as a handicapped. It completely transformed her life. And still, she was a wonderful mother. In that respect, you know, I think she was really able, because she was working from home. No, sorry, because she was living at home from then on, because she was no longer capable of working. I had a mother who was home every time I came home from school. So to me, it was actually, as hard as it was for her, it was a very positive experience for me to witness it and to be closer to my mother because of it, and to see her do the work. And to see how much work it was. So in my late 20s, I started experiencing symptoms as well. And because I'd seen my mother go through it, I knew, you know, there was the real advantage of knowing what was happening. I didn't have to go through the craziness of what I can imagine someone else going through this. From what I understand, schizoaffective disorder is in the same umbrella, same family as schizophrenia, but not like classic schizophrenia. I can't tell you the distinctions, because I did not go through the system. That was a choice of mine that I just, for me, I just didn't know what the system could offer. You know, I didn't want to be medicated. I did not want to be medicated. I don't know why it was such a visceral, it was like almost like, and I don't even know why I was so against medication. Like it, when I think back, I'm like, wow, I was really determined. And like my greatest fear was that it would, that my condition would degenerate to a point where I would be, you know, end up in an asylum. And then my fear was not the asylum. My fear was that they would then force me to medicate. So I don't know why I was so terrified of being medicated, but you know, now in retrospect, I think that there's something very deep inside me that understood that medication would completely stall my healing, because it would cut me off from all the things that I needed to heal. So it's kind of difficult to describe the symptoms because it's very intangible. I say like it's an altered state. And when I'm in those times of altered state, my memory of it afterwards is not as great. But the way I can describe it is just a complete disintegration of reality. I mean, complete is a big word, but your reality can just shift from one moment to the next, and you just start perceiving things completely differently. And there are things that happen that I just had no explanations for. And I think for me, a big part of the journey, and I spoke to a friend while traveling, and he was deeply into spirituality. And I told him about my experiences. And he said, you know, I think what you had is just a really big spiritual awakening. And I really appreciated him for saying that, because I think it was like a spiritual awakening that is like somebody took a bat to your head. Like that's, you know, about as gentle as it is. But it definitely did lead to a spiritual awakening. And I was very fortunate that the disease did not degenerate too much, because although it was degenerating quite quickly, in the nick of time, I discovered completely by chance acupuncture. In that somehow after five treatments for something else completely unrelated, I had my first bout of normalcy. I think I had like 5 days of normalcy after having been struggling for a year of degenerating mental health. And it was, I still remember those 5 days as being so blissful. And so then acupuncture became my lifeline, and it helped me claw back from the edge. And since then, I mean, it's come back, it's come and left, and it's a life's journey. And I have many, 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 many more tools now. But yeah, I guess I'm not sure where I want to go with this. But I think what I'll leave this with is that for me, my choice to not go the conventional medical route was the best choice I could have made, because it left me open to so many other modalities, alternative medicines, and I was willing to try everything and anything. I didn't care how scientific it was. I was like, if it works, it works. And what I found is that I found so much is out there. And I found so many professionals who truly, truly embraced my reality, because my reality was no longer conventional. And I needed to speak to people who could really come to where I was at, who could really step into my understanding of my own experience and work with me where I was at. And, you know, if I spoke of past lives, if I spoke of energies or entities, like they were there with me. They were like, they worked with me on that level, which is not something I'm confident I could have found in conventional medicine. So I'm just really grateful that all these resources exist. Yeah.
Celeste, first, I want to tell you how thankful and grateful I am that you shared this mm-hmm. with us. I know that it's you're vulnerable right now. You're sharing something mm-hmm. that's really close to you. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for the work that you do. Thanks. And how aware you are of your body and your mind and your spirit. And to say you're a shining light, but you're absolutely someone I've met who is doing the work, and maintaining good mental health is, mm-hmm. it is a part of, I would almost say it's a part of your lifestyle.
Oh yeah.
Right? Huge. Like it is every day you are engaged with this part of you, and that you have an awareness that I think many people might envy, but it's not to suggest in any way that there wasn't a lot of work involved.
Mm-hmm. Thank
taking
you.
Years to get here. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us.
Thanks, Stephanie. I really appreciate that too. Thanks.
Yeah. We're gonna slide over to Anthea, and just curious, what you have to say.
Yeah, sure. So, and I think you've just touched on it's a deeply personal topic, I think, tied up with our journeys through understanding our mental health. And Celeste, as you were talking, there's so much that you were saying that I was resonating with. Mm-hmm. I had a slightly different experience to you in terms of I went through the traditional sort of medical mental health route, but accessing that was incredibly difficult, and it's been a journey, first of all, around education of where to go, but then also the tenacity that's required to get the right help and call it when you might be seeing a doctor or a psychologist or on a medication that isn't helping. I think it takes a lot of bravery, because quite often it's easy to, a doctor has prescribed this particular medication to help with this, so it must be working. I'm not that educated in terms of medical things. Who am I to question it? And so building that confidence in yourself to be able to say, have that conversational relationship with your doctor, and finding a doctor that is on the same page. I've certainly been through quite a number, and now the doctor, the GP that I have, is like gold. I will not let him go at all, because I remember walking in, I was getting a checkup for something else, for a different medical issue, and he asked me how I was, and I burst into tears, and about an hour and a half later I walked out of there with a mental health plan and a referral to GPs. How many patients would experience that with their local GP or medical center here in Australia? I'm not sure if it's the same in Canada. I experience probably, and I'm not sure, Steph, if we need to put a trigger warning on this, but I experienced my first suicidal ideation in when I was living by myself in Sydney, and it was probably off the back of some pretty severe workplace bullying and workplace stress. And that was, I remember thinking, how did I let it, and the guilt around, how did I let it get to this point where I'm so low? And that was probably the first experience that I've had with that. I've definitely had others since, but the really consistent theme that I've had through my journey has been the network that I've had around me who've been able to intervene and having that those friendships and those relationships, including at work. I've been very fortunate to work for at different workplaces, bosses who have been very well educated around mental health issues and supporting their teams. And that's probably sparked a bit of an interest for me around how organizations can support their leaders to have those conversations. Because quite often the time that we spend at work, our colleagues mm-hmm. are going to be those people who notice those changes in us, or, you know, that, you know, for a period of time we haven't been ourselves, or we don't have our usual pizzazz, or something's not quite right. And so being able to be that early intervention and help our teams access the support that they need and stick with them through that process until they get to, you know, whether they choose to go through the medical system or not, but get to a place where the professionals can help.
Yeah, I think
that was really disjointed.
No, not at all. Not at all. I made a couple notes. One of the things I wrote is, it helpful to hide our struggles, right? And the other thing to that was, when I was suffering postpartum depression, once I started to get better, I started to discover how many people knew I wasn't okay, but never said anything because they thought I knew I wasn't. But
and
I didn't
stigma
know.
And maybe there's like shame or uncertainty around, can we address this with people in our lives? Like, are they going to feel like I'm overstepping if I suggest that maybe they need help with their mental health?
Yeah, it's a fine line between, you know, offending someone and getting them the help that they need. I'm just having a bad day. I don't need any help. No, I'm having a bad time and I actually need help. I think it's hard to determine that. Yeah.
And definitely, like, you know, I mentioned in the workplace, I'm not for a second suggesting that leaders become mental health professionals. And there's definitely a duty of care versus overstepping there. And as a leader, also maintaining your own boundaries around in terms of that degree of assistance. I've been very grateful for the leaders that I've had in my experience who've walked me out the door to the to the doctor, but yeah, I like finding that balance where you can be empathetic and caring, but also allow everyone their agency.
Well, and on that, I think I'd really like to pull in Mary, who I think has a perspective in working with people in environments and managing people. Mary, can I pull you in here?
Of course. I just wanted to take a quick second to unpack that idea about whether or not somebody would be offended by being approached and asked if they were okay. I think that a lot of work needs to be done in normalizing mental health and mental health struggles, especially after the last 2 years that we have all gone through together. And that the idea that you're not doing well should in any way be shameful or taboo is sadly part of the problem. If you have allergies, everybody and their neighbor will tell you their favorite. And if you break your leg, you go and get a cast and people say, oh, rough shuffle. But if you're struggling with mental health, it's still considered to be somewhat shameful. So I just wanted to stick that in. And I'm going to talk for just a moment about working in the mental health field. And certainly I can echo from my own personal private experience, everybody else has said about how impenetrable and opaque the system is. And I think of myself with my own mental health struggles and, you know, I own a computer, I have Wi-Fi at my home, English is my first language, I went to university, so I know how to do research. And even with all of those privileges, it is incredibly difficult to find a way to get help. And that really harms a lot of people. One of the many different kinds of agencies that I worked at was one where I supervised a team of social workers who were case managers for people with severe and persistent mental illness. And these staff were expert in navigating the system and could help somebody find a therapist and housing and address their physical needs and get them help with their bed bugs and anything else that they might need because life was so incredibly difficult. And that was a really simple system that made a wonderful amount of difference. But I have to tell you, in all of the many jobs I've had, and some of them were quite wonderful, I got to tell you, working in mental health services is absolutely terrible for your mental health. It is so debilitating. Mm-hmm. I often, when a contract would finish, would need to take off 6 months and just use up all my carefully hoarded savings because I had lost the ability to go in and do it anymore. I needed to recover. Part of the problem is that there has been an ongoing situation in Canada and particularly in Ontario where people with mental illness, especially those with severe and persistent mental illness, are considered disposable and somehow shameful by taxpayers. And when the limited amount of spending that's available in healthcare dollars comes around and it's like, well, do you want to help this guy who's living on the street or do you want to get an MRI for your hospital so that your dad doesn't have an appointment at midnight 6 months from now? There's just not a lot of political will to support these people, even though there are many, many studies that document that when people get the services that they need, it actually raises the health and the mental health of everyone in the population. It's not even just specific people. So it's a real shame that those people are made to feel less than and that they are pitted against other things that are way more expensive that makes them feel like they will never be able to get the service that they need. The situation that that creates in mental health services is that over the past few decades, the increase in demand has been met by a decrease in supply, and every worker is expected to carry the weight of two or three or four employees, which is not tenable over the long term. I've always been really comfortable in middle management, and my experience almost 100% of the time has been that the people whose job it was to supervise and train and support me were completely unable to do so because they were too overwhelmed and too burnt out themselves. So it's a really vicious cycle. And I don't know what the easy or quick solution would be, but in the end, everybody suffers.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no Band-Aid solution that's going to fit all the people that need help. And it is a real shame that, as you were saying, that, you know, as there's an increase in demand for support, there's a decrease in funding. I think that what's occurred over the last two and a half years around the world, I mean, one of the only ways out of this is more investment in healthcare and specifically more supports for mental health services.
Yeah, and I get it. Sorry, just the last thought about in the national health plan that we have in Canada, I get it that when the smart, wise people who were putting that together a long time ago didn't actually understand how profoundly mental health affects every aspect of people's lives, including physical health and hospitalization and all of the costs in policing and jails and hospitals and on and on and on. And it's now seen as being too late to add it in, just like dental, because it would be so very, very expensive. And I also get it that the reason that psychiatrists are able to offer mental health services for free is because they have a medical degree and they have a governing body. But psychiatry, while a lifesaver for many people, is not the right answer for everybody and has done irreparable harm to some people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whew. That's a, I don't know if it's a lot to unpack, but I do
Mary, want to say I am glad that you called me out on my use of language before I brought you in, and that what I said is actually part of the problem, right?
That I think that might have even been me that mentioned that about the shame.
Well, for me, accessing mental health support, there was a disbelief on my part that, what do you mean that I could be an addict, right? And that this could be my problem, but it was there. And I've spoken to other women of my age demographic, and so we were, you know, children of the 80s, teenagers of the 90s. And there are a considerable number of us that grew up specifically with mothers who were anti-medication, that you don't need to take medication. There's nothing wrong with you. And now I understand that a lot of these women were women who needed support and were not provided that, or the initial response from their doctors and their family was, here, take this medication. And if they weren't willing to do it, there was nothing for them. So I think that there's some women in their 30s, well, not 30s, maybe their 40s to about 55, that grew up with that taboo, that medication was shameful. It's not a thing that you did. And I think that was harmful for me. And it actually took, I hosted a breakfast brunch for a bunch of people. And I think it was specifically for friends with kids, but a woman showed up, and she was actually one of the, this is what actually turned me after probably a year or more of suffering with postpartum depression. And she just started sharing with me she didn't share what had happened, but she said, you know, Stephanie, I had this thing that happened. It was traumatic, and I just got stuck in this place where I couldn't move forward and I couldn't function. And she said, and I opened myself to the possibility of medication. And she said, and I took it. And she said, in that 6 months, she said, it gave me space to breathe so that I could manage and start to get the support that I needed and start to advocate for myself. And she shared with me that for her, medication meant that she only needed to be on antidepressants for a short period of time, and she was able to sort herself out. And in her sharing that with me, it was the first time I realized that this is a possibility for me. I can take this medication. And like she said, it actually within a couple of weeks, I felt like I had space to breathe and that I could actually start putting in the work that I needed to do to get better. The reality is for me, based on what I am learning about myself, is that I may be someone who needs to be on medication the rest of my life, but I'm okay with that now. But 5.5, 6 years ago, I was suffering under that stigma that I shouldn't need it. Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting as well, like what you were saying, Steph, in terms of the shame around internalized shame around taking medication, but also tying in with what Celeste was sharing in terms of her mother's experience, of the flip side of that, the impact that taking medication might have, and the fear that if I start taking this medication, is that just going to make me feel like I've got nothing? I definitely know I've had their mental health treatment plans, and that's been probably one of the first questions that's come up in conversation, is like, how do you find the meds affect you? Do you still feel things? I'm not a medical expert, so I'm not sure if there's changes to medication that's happened over the last couple of decades that's changed that. I know I definitely had to try a few to get the right one, and that had quite a prohibitive effect, because I stopped taking my medication, then I'd spiral, and then I'd feel really daunted by the prospect of starting a new medication and knowing that I had a period of side effects to work through to find the right one.
I think it's also, from my perspective, I feel that people are left with very few go-to choices. You know, it's like, I feel bad, I need to go see a professional. Okay, I'll go see a professional who's licensed, so a psychiatrist, whatever. And then they're going to offer me meds and psychotherapy. Okay. But I mean, for me personally, those, well, meds were not an option for me, and psychotherapy just, it never worked for me. It just, you know, I hear great things about it for other people, hear great things about meds for other people as well, but just never really worked for me. And, you know, sometimes I look at my own experience and over the years of finding different modalities, finding different things that help me in different kinds of professional. And, you know, there's a part of me that, so I don't currently have really much of a relationship with my mother, but, you know, there's still the part of me that thinks, oh, if only I could share with her what I know now, because I'm sure it would have helped her so tremendously. But then I think, no, actually, because all the things that helped me, she would never do, because she doesn't even believe in those things, right? Like she, yeah. Mm. There's things like homeopathy. Well, homeopathy is, if you're familiar with it, there's no scientific explanation that really makes sense about how homeopathy works, right? But I don't care. Like, I tried it, it worked, and it changed my life. And it's even worked on my cat. So tell me it's a placebo, fine. I don't care. I'll pay for a placebo if that's what works. Like, and you know, so many things. Like my life has really expanded through my exploration of healing, because there are so many things that I didn't even understand were real. And, you know, understanding energy, presences, the spirit world. I mean, I think that my mind and its falling apart, it opened up to so much more about reality. And I think that the real difficulty is that, you know, it's so hard to, there's something hugely comforting about the medical system and conventional knowledge, because it seems very factual. It seems very like, yes, we all know this is true. But at some point, it doesn't necessarily help you to know the medical truth of your situation. And sometimes you just need people who are gonna like take that leap with you and be like, you know what? I believe that what you experience is real, because that actually, that was a huge turning point for me. When I first started experiencing symptoms, at first I thought, okay, I just need to decide this is real and this is not. And then all these things that are not real, I'm just going to like put them to the side. I'm just going to ignore them. And I'm just going to like, they're just not real. And it seemed like a very orderly way of going about my life, but I wasn't progressing. And then at one point, I just kind of had this moment that really shifted the course for me. And I just decided, you know what? I don't care anymore what's real, what's not. If it's real to me, it's real. End of story. And at that point, it allowed me to encompass my entire experience and work with my entire experience, and finally was able to move forward in a significant way, because a big part of my healing was redefining my reality. And I couldn't do that if I was discounting half of my reality. And I remember being in a clinic in a conversation with a woman who was, I believe, a psychologist. And it was just a roundtable conversation. It wasn't really intended to treat or diagnose. But I spoke of my experience, and she said to me, you know, you just have to become comfortable with understanding what's an illusion and what's not. And I always remember looking at her and thinking to myself, I just answered, like my answer was like, well, what is illusion? But in my head, I thought, no, your entire life is an illusion. The only difference between you and me is that I know it. And and that has been my stance, like, and it's really helped for me. It's really helped for me to embrace my entire experience.
I want thank you for sharing that. I wanted to touch base on something that you had said about needing to try a few medications. before you found the right one for you. And I recall when I went to my doctor and finally said, okay, like, let's do this. And she started on me on her, the question was, because it was either medication A or medication B. And she said, what kind of bowel movements do you have? And I kind of looked at her and she said, well, look, one of these is going to make you constipated and one of these is going to give you diarrhea. Oh, and based on your current situation, we're going to give you the one that does the opposite of what you already have. And that was where we started me. And interestingly, the extremely low starter dose that she put me on worked for a good 5 years. And it's only in the pandemic that we actually upped it, and we upped it very minimally. And so that's worked for me, but I know a lot of other people who have started a medication, then they've had to ramp up very quickly, or they've had to try other ones, which I think to what you said earlier can be really frustrating, and it can not be demoralizing, but it can be discouraging, you know, because if you start to take this thing or you start to implement this mental health tool and you have to keep restarting, and that suffering just continues and continues, and it can feel like a fruitless journey sometimes.
Yeah. Or having to choose between, you know, do I want to feel okay or have a sex life?
It's so true.
Because, like, yeah, the impact that some meds that I was on initially that had on my libido, I was just like, wow. Yeah, there was nothing going on there. Or, you know, am I going to feel okay mentally, but then also just travel through each day feeling a little nauseous? And that's got its own, like, impact in terms of just how you travel through the day. Thankfully, like, the medication that I'm on now is awesome, and it makes such a difference. But I think it's really nice also, Celeste, what you were saying in terms of being really aware of your whole experience. Yeah, and having others validate that it's not, you know, just part of what you're experiencing, but yeah. Sorry, I don't have a fully formed thought around it. I'm just kind of like what you were saying in terms of having people validate your whole experience is kind of percolating with me a little bit at the moment. So yeah,
I also feel like just hearing I think sometimes we focus a lot on the short term with mental health because, you know, when you're in a crisis, you're just like, okay, like I just need to get to work tomorrow and I just need to finish the week. You know, I used to have a moral stance against medication. I certainly do not anymore. I think, not that I had a very strong moral stance against it, but for like now that I've seen so many and heard so many people's stories, I don't think that that's really in the end what defines your experience, whether or not you use medication. You know, I think what I see is a lot of people working really damn hard for the long term to get themselves to a better place, because even though you may be experiencing a crisis in the moment, yeah, you know what, maybe that pill is going to keep you from jumping off the roof of a 12-story building, then please by all means take the pill, like you know. But I think, you know, for me, what I see as the differentiating factor is really over the long term. Then that's where you really see the people who are really willing to work and who are really willing to just, because it's a very long-term thing. Like, you don't, you know, it's not just like, oh, you're about to jump off a building one day and then, you know, a week later you're like, oh, I'm fine, I didn't know what that was about. Like, no, this is something that is a journey, a very long journey. And I think it's really, you know, your attitude will define your journey. And I think meds or no, that's not really what's going to make it's not going to define your success in the end.
Yeah. Well, and the medication is just one tool in your larger toolbox, right? Mm-hmm. That medication doesn't solve everything. There's still an underlying something. I don't know if it's an issue, but there's something under all of that that still needs to be acknowledged, that still needs to be, for lack of a better word, dissected and understood, that what has brought us here, whether it's trauma, whether it's abuse, whether, I don't know, whether things can trigger poor mental health. Mm-hmm. And you're right, Celeste, good mental health, and I don't want to say mental illness, but maybe mental fitness, is a lifelong endeavor. And we're constantly putting tools in our toolbox and learning new things, and also making the choices to not engage in the activities that don't help our mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, before we kind of launch into maybe talking about the things we have engaged in, I maybe wanted to pull in Mary to see if there's anything else she wanted to talk about in terms of your experiences or your experiences in the workplace.
Absolutely. Thank you. I just wanted to say that getting it to piggyback on what you guys have just been talking about, it's getting the opportunity to do that work that is the biggest stumbling block. So, Stephanie, I loved your story about, you know, pick constipation or diarrhea. We all know that working on your mental health is a chance to deal with your own shit. So, so you got to deal with that in a very literal way. One of the things that people don't talk about is that when you're looking for a practitioner, and it's not just about how difficult it can be to get the right dose of the right medication and how many different times you have to restart that process, which for some people is just so depressing if it's difficult to find the right thing for them. But it's also trying to get the opportunity to do the hard work of actually being in therapy. And one thing that people don't talk about is that every single time you call up a new place and you talk to an intake worker and you get put on another waiting list, you have to tell your story again and again, and it re-traumatizes you every single time. And that's incredibly frustrating. And I remember many years ago when my dad died, so I was dealing with grief and I was dealing with issues coming up from early trauma that were pretty profound. And I really was willing and able and ready to do the hard work of facing that and going through it and learning and growing from it. And my doctor gave me every referral he could possibly find. And I was doing my own research and I just kept hitting closed doors and waiting lists, and our waiting list is closed. And I'll never forget one particular fella. I got a referral to a psychiatrist hospital, and apparently he's at the top of his field. And I thought, this is great to work with somebody with that much experience and that much skill. Sounds really, really helpful. I'm looking forward to that. So I go to the appointment, and lo and behold, the great white man, the great white old man, is nowhere to be found. And I have to do an intake interview with, what do you call it when they're practicing to be a doctor?
Oh, like an intern?
Yeah.
Or a resident?
Yeah, with a resident. And so the resident said, I told him my whole story. And I was grieving. I was dealing with trauma. Neither one of those things is a chemical imbalance, by the way. Mm-hmm. I told him my whole story. And he said, okay, I'm going to put you on this drug. And then you can come back 6 months from now and tell me how you feel. And I said, well, I'm not against medication. I've seen it do wonders for people. And I'm perfectly willing to try. However, the reason that I'm here is that I'm ready and willing and able to do the hard work. And I actually want therapy. And if drugs are part of that therapy, that's great. But I really need to do the work. And he said, well, it's drugs or nothing. And I said, thank you very much. And I left. And he went to the trouble of writing a letter to my doctor to tell my doctor that I was resistant to treatment.
What?
And oh, it's awful.
I often think about that arrogant prick and the amount of harm he must have done throughout his career then.
That's awful. I'm so sorry that happened.
Me too. Thank you. I'm still mad about it.
Yeah, as you should be. And I don't think that the system has really improved, right? That there are plenty of doctors. And I remember when I finally found a therapist who was just going to do talk therapy with me, and I had shared my experience trying to find help for postpartum. And I said, oh, I was seeing this doctor at this hospital. And they said, oh yeah, she's actually known in the medical system as just a pill pusher. Yeah, she won't help you.
Oh,
and it was like, what? Like, how did I end up there? I was very clear that I didn't want to do that, you know? And it's, I can't believe that that's still how they just see, oh yeah, we'll just give you this. It'll be fine. No, I want to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think the other part to doing the work is, I mean, I think, and I'm Anthea, please correct me if I'm wrong, but between Canada and Australia, we have a public health system.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot imagine trying to do this work living in a place where you don't have a public system, where you have to pay for everything, every step of the way. Medication becomes prohibitive, right? I can't take these meds because that means I can't pay my mortgage or my rent, or I can't feed my kids, right? That there are people out there that have to make that decision between their well-being and getting the help they need, whether it's medication or therapy or tools for their toolbox, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Mm-hmm. They have to make that choice between actively being involved in their wellness or just paying their bills and continuing to survive. I can't imagine going through what I've gone through and having lived in that kind of medical assistant, especially if you don't have insurance.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree that the Canadian healthcare system subsidizes mental health, but it's still pretty expensive here. So our government subsidizes to a point, but if you need sort of that long-term, you know, whether it's talk therapy or, you know, access to mental health services, or heaven forbid, you know, like have to go into an inpatient facility for a few weeks, that's hella expensive. That's tens of thousands of dollars.
And like, who has that in this day and age?
No. I mean, we have, and I don't know if it's the same in Canada, but like a retirement savings scheme, and you can access some of those savings for if you need a program here. But you need to submit forms for it and that kind of thing. And it's still, you know, you're choosing between your retirement quality of life versus your quality of life now.
Wow.
Those are tough decisions.
Yeah.
They have consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're withdrawing on those super savings now, you know, that's future investment income that, you know, has an exponential impact in your retirement because you're taking the lump now. Not to, you know, I'm not an economist, so I'll put an asterisk around that. but yeah, like I think there's steps that are being made in countries like Australia and Canada where access to mental health services is covered by public health, but I think there's still to go.
Go ahead, Celeste.
What this makes me think, talking about the cost of healthcare, is the personal cost of experiencing mental instability or mental disease is so huge on a person's life, far beyond whatever money you're ever going to put on the table.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, I always think the most important thing I have is my body and my health and my mind, because I've seen very, very up close what could happen if I lost. I could lose everything. I mean, forget the money. I could have lost, you know, my partner, my career, my future, my autonomy. I could have lost everything. And there, it is so crazy terrifying. And I think it just lit a fire under my ass to be like, I don't fucking care how much money I have to put into this. I spend more money on my health and my mental health, physical health, healthcare. I spend more on that probably than I do on groceries. Like, it's just, it can take everything away from you. So it's so important. Sure, I can jump in. So I have a whole array of tools at this point. I would say I can kind of separate them into categories. So there's the tools that are, you know, healthcare professionals. I found what has worked incredibly well for me are energy-based tools, which not everybody believes in energy, so it limits a lot of people, but through trial and error, I respond extremely well to things. So the heavy hitters in this field would be homeopathy, who also, it's not just homeopathy, she's also not psychotherapist, but I don't know what the official title is, but it's some kind of counseling. So that all kind of fits into there. Chiropractic has really helped as well, and acupuncture and Reiki has really been great. There's so much out there. And you can't do it all at the same time. They all kind of work at different times. and then there's also being really fucking healthy. Like, that just, it makes everything so much better. So I spend a lot of time and energy on my nutrition. I do yoga daily. I meditate daily. Part of the symptoms is that I really struggle to sleep. And so I will focus a lot on normalizing my circadian rhythm and improving my sleep patterns. And every night before I go to sleep, I take a cold shower, as cold as I can make it. And I count 2 minutes, and it's brutal, but it works better than a sleeping pill. So I, you know, I do that. And so I think for me, it's a balance of the professionals I work with, how much I take care of my own physical health. And then a ton of inner journeying, a lot of inner work, a lot of spiritual work. I've done a lot of, you know, I studied, they called it shamanism. I don't know. It was a mishmash of spiritual knowledge. And just, you know, I just routinely communicate with the spirit world intentionally, as opposed to just letting it hit me with like a ton of bricks. So that's what's worked for me.
Thank you for that. Mary or Anthea, did either one of you want to go next?
Yeah, I can jump in. Celeste, you stole quite a few from my list, actually. I would really echo what you were talking about in terms of I have probably struggled a little bit with alcohol over the years, and I know when I have alcohol, that will have an impact on how I feel. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't need to be a lot, but it will. And so just being super conscious about making that choice intentionally and being prepared for the next few days after that. Sleep is another really key one for me. And I notice if I'm running on low sleep, I know that I'm going to be in for a pretty wobbly time pretty shortly. And the impact that eating, in particular, green, healthy, leafy vegetables has is really profound in terms of how I feel. And obviously don't only just eat green leafy vegetables, but you know, I notice that if I eat the way that I feel like my body knows to eat, within a week I'll be feeling a lot better than I did a week prior to that. Spirituality for me is a really key one, and it's like finding the right meds, finding the right sort of spiritual pathway that resonates with me as an individual has taken a few sort of stabs at things that have worked or haven't worked. But I feel like I've kind of found the way that I can incorporate my spirituality into my day-to-day through movement and meditation and, you know, whatever. You know, I have an altar. I have crystal.
Yeah.
I use during the day that help with particular things, and that, you know, whether it's a placebo or not, I kind of don't care.
Nope.
Exactly like you were saying, Celeste, like, you know, it's actually, it's something that I've accessed that's worked for me. And, you know, it, dancing, and I know this is going to sound super woo woo, but, like dancing my prayers, like putting on some beats and just dropping in has really helped.
Amazing.
And also being really conscious of my home and work environment. If I've got a messy house, I know that I'm going to feel wobbly. I'm going to be snappier. I'm going to be more irritable. I'm going to have that anxiety and tightness in my chest. And likewise in my work environment, whether it's thanks, but also the emotional security that's available to me in my work environment is really key for me to feel like I can be myself without shame, but also say, hey, I'm not having a great day today. I might be a little light. That's probably been a pretty key enabler for me to be able to work through those days where I'm feeling pretty shit.
I think that being able to acknowledge when you're not having a good day and that you're not in a good space, especially when you're in a leadership position in your employment, is really important, because I think it sets the standard for your staff or the people that work with you, and it opens the door for them to be vulnerable with you when they need to be. And then you can respond in the appropriate way. I want to jump into Mary and see if you have anything that you want to add to our discussion of things in our toolboxes.
Certainly, there's a lot of commonality. I've always had a very good diet. I've always slept like a champion, thank God. I know that exercise, although I'm a natural born slug, it certainly does a great deal to improve my energy and my mood. So I really try to pay attention to that. I've been trying to learn how to meditate for years. Perhaps someday I'll actually be able to do it. Talk therapy is my absolute favorite way of surfacing issues and getting insights and moving forward. And if I won the lottery, I would engage in it on a regular basis. There have been some times in my life where it's been extraordinarily helpful to me, but the times when I needed it far outstripped the times when I was actually able to afford to pay for it. And one thing that's a little weird about my brain chemistry is that when I get in one of those spirals where I'm just the miserable thinking and the depression thinking, and it just goes around and around and around in a circle, and you get trapped in there and you get lower and lower, I have found, interestingly enough, that the combination of having a toke and having a glass of wine for me is actually a reset for my brain. And when I'm in that state, I actually make breakthroughs and come up with insights. And it's not like, oh, it's great, I'm so high. It's like literally the next day and for days afterwards, I feel more centered. The realizations and insights that I came up with hold true. So it's a very interesting way that my brain gets at stuff that might be a little more difficult to surface in a conscious way. And obviously that doesn't work for everybody. And of course, I also have to say that I had heart failure a few months ago, and now I can't have alcohol anymore. So that's no longer in my toolbox. I know, I kind of feel like coffee and alcohol were like really good friends, and I'm grooving them a little bit. But I found it, I had always found it really interesting that for me, it was a therapeutic tool that I knew how to use for my own benefit. And I don't know if other people have similar experiences or not.
I think, well, marijuana for me had a time where it did help me, but it stopped being a support quite some time ago for me. But I mean, but unlike you, you know, you're saying you would have a little toke, but as an ex-smoker, I would just smoke a whole joint because I love smoking. So for me personally, there came a point where it was no longer serving me, and I've taken, I've made the choice to take it out of my toolbox because it was actually starting to perpetuate some of the mental health issues that I was having. Or it was not perpetuating them, but it just wasn't helping me. But I'm really happy to hear that it works for you and that it's a tool you have that you, except for losing the alcohol, you can tap into.
I just said my friend. I miss my friend.
I think my toolbox echoes quite a bit of what you've all shared. I've sat Vipassana quite a few times, and that technique of learning meditation as a technique was quite life-changing, because I find that the technique of Vipassana is something that once you learn it, you can tap into it at any time. And I think, Anthea, I want to echo what you were saying about dancing. Actually, dancing is a huge release for me. And part of my recovery from postpartum, dance was a very significant part of that. And it still is. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And something else I want to add that has, in the last few years of the pandemic, because I was alone a lot, and something that started to be missing for me was just safe touch. And I have three practitioners. One is an osteopath and one is a massage therapist, and they're both male. And I would go to them, and I have been supported by these two individuals for years. But in the pandemic, I would show up, and when they were able to see me, and I would sit there and I would cry, and I remember saying to them, like, I just need safe touch, and I need that masculinity. And these two men supported my physical, my spiritual, and my emotional well-being in a way that I saw one of them today that started my day off, one of them. And, you know, for me, that was something that really, really worked. And, you know, given that they're professionals, I was able to be vulnerable and to feel safe, which I think for a lot of women can be hard to be with these men and having them touch you. But also, you know, I mean, there were times that I would show up to my osteopath and I would just say, I'm so heartbroken, like, I'm so lost. And he would say, that's okay, Stephanie. He's Parisian too, so he has this beautiful accent. And he's, today we're going to work on opening your heart. And I was able to lay on those tables and let my grief and my pain go. And I was fully supported. There was no judgment. There was no hurry up and stop crying, move on from this. Just, we are going to hold space for you until you're okay. And so I think that was one of the things that took me time to get to, but it's been really helpful. Also crying is a great release for me. So before we've gone on quite a bit today. So before I close our gathering, is there any other tools or comments anyone wants to make? Anything else you want to share?
I'm just going to say, I'm very happy that we're all here in this space sharing our stories, because mental illness can be so isolating, and it's crazy how we seem so functional and we seem so capable. And yet when we speak, I just realize, wow, like, we're all, none of us are alone. It's really incredible.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And I want to thank all of you gals for your courage and your noble humility in sharing your truth and your stories. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, it really has been wonderful. I'm going to, oops, sorry, Anthea.
Oh, no, I was also just going to say thank you, and thank you for accommodating the Australian time zone.
Yeah, it's tomorrow where you are.
Yeah, I'm calling from the future.
So before I let you go, I'm actually, two of my
really close girlfriends both shared this with me in the last 24 hours. So I'm going to read a list by Holistically Grace. I haven't checked out their Instagram, but they're at Holistically Grace. And my mental health, it's a list, and it starts with, my mental health started to improve when I stopped lying to myself, created space from friendships I had outgrown, set fire to the labels I thought defined me, set a bedtime and stuck to it, eased into the joy of missing out, said yes to interests, even if I had to go alone, sought out prayer and spiritual nourishment, exercised to feel good and not lose weight, sorry, explored my relationship with alcohol and drugs, had really, really, really hard conversations, stopped accepting inconsistency, grieved the loss of the life I had envisioned, and paid more attention to what was working. So I just wanted to leave that. I mean, I know that this list is for mental health and it doesn't resolve the situation for people struggling with mental illness, but hopefully people listening to this, that something in this discussion is resonating with anyone out there who's listening. And if you are in need of support, please just keep reaching out. I really believe that all of the women in this discussion have struggled to access the supports that they needed. And each one of you is a success story in your own journey to having good mental health through really significant struggles. And I really want to thank all of you for coming and sharing in this conversation. I love all of you women so much. I'm so glad you're here.
So glad you're here.
So glad you're here.
So glad you're here.
And grateful too. We forgot to mention gratitude, but I'm grateful to you, Stephanie, for this forum. Thank you.
Oh, yes. Thank you for being vulnerable.
If you're interested in joining the monthly Ode Bitch Boast Gathering, you can find event listings and tickets, which are free, on Eventbrite, as well as on the Town Ritual Facebook page. Search Town Rituals online. If you'd like to participate in a future podcast, please send me an email at townrituals@gmail.com, noting podcast in the subject line.
Cool. Love you all. Thank you.
Love you.
As Grandma said, love you and leave you.
Wonderful.
That's hilarious.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Hello and welcome to Town Rituals Red Tent Gathering. In this episode, I've invited guests to share their journey to pregnancy or the decision not to procreate. All right, let's try this again. Last time's a charm. Three, two, one. Hello and welcome to Town Rituals Red Tent Gathering. In this episode, I've invited guests to share their stories to pregnancy, raising children, or not. Some of the guests in this episode will join me again in episode 2 as they move through the transformation of choice to reality. My journey to pregnancy was pretty typical. A child was wanted and was created by choice and in love. A little less than a decade ago, my child's father and I decided to throw caution to the wind and we stopped using contraception. I personally thought it would take us a few months, at least 6, before we got pregnant. Truth is, I was pregnant within a couple of months, my body beginning the transformation and parenthood closer every day. My pregnancy was fairly normal and pretty good, all things considered, until the end, when baby was 15 days late and I had very bad edema, retaining a substantial amount of water weight, which thankfully shed within a week or two of the birth. Their birth, however, was ultimately an emergency C-section, my dilation never getting beyond 5 centimeters. Once they were out, we discovered, the cord wrapped twice around their neck, my placenta badly depleted. The experience in many ways was traumatic and stressful for quite a few of us. I still feel echoes of the C-section in my body when I think about it. I'm fortunate to live in a country with public health care. I'm so grateful for my midwife, the OB who did the surgery, even though he was a bit of an asshole, the nursing staff, and my favorite, the anesthesiologist. And let's not forget my son's father, who was so supportive. There are so many things, so much advice out there in the world on how to parent. My own reflection is that nothing really prepares you for what is about to occur in your life when you decide to become a parent. We left the hospital and I walked into my home holding my newborn, and I stood in the front hallway crying. I didn't know what to do. Where do I put it? What do I do with myself? Is it breathing? Does it need to be fed? Changed? We all eventually settled into a routine and life developed its own flow with some difficulty. My milk required a lot of encouragement to come in, pumping quite a bit. My chest so swollen at the start, it made it difficult for the baby to latch. I also navigated the healthcare system to access mental health support while trying to survive postpartum depression, which I've discussed in season one in a previous episode. Truth is, children arrive in our lives in all sorts of ways and are raised by all manner and many people. These are a few of their stories. Thank you for listening. Thanks for being here today.